It before, but if you don't put it on carefully, you press it again accidentally, and then it turns off. Yes, all of the insults I've said yesterday were not recorded, so I'm safe. Okay, so what did we do last time? We dealt with magnetic energy. It's kind of what came next. And we had a bunch of equivalent formulas for calculating magnetic energy that are exactly analogous to what we had for electricity. So right, for electricity, we had the 1/2, the charge times the voltage. I've switched to V's now because now phis are flux recently. Or we could have this sort of thing, or we could multiply charge densities times voltages, or we could add up electric fields. So pretty much exactly, you know, just transpose things and use M's as opposed to P's, and you're all set for the formulas for magnetic energy. One thing you do want to be a little bit careful about is the sign convention that relates the direction that you've chosen for your currents, and then the right-hand rule that has to apply for the normal to that surface when you're calculating the flux. So there's a little bit of a trick there. It's probably worth writing down the very simplest case where you just have self-inductance, so there's only one coil. So the only thing you have is an M11, and an M11 is called the self-inductance L. So then this formula just reduces to the potential energy is 1/2 Li squared. And for capacitors, it was 1/2 CV squared, right? So it's all the same, right? It's all the same except for magnetic fields being a lot trickier because they've got that cross product stuff and they've got a vector potential as opposed to a scalar potential. So it's surprisingly similar. For the electrical case, we had kind of two important cases where the charges were held constant and where the voltages were held constant. If the charges were held constant, then we get what we expect, that force is minus the derivative of the potential energy and things go downhill. If things were connected to batteries, the battery is going to do work, and you could in fact calculate the force with plus the derivative with respect to x of the potential energy. So for circuits, effectively there's just one case where the currents are held constant. There is another possibility where the fluxes are held constant, in which case you'd get minus signs, but that's not a very commonly occurring case. The starting point for all of this stuff was to get some sort of formula for the magnetic energy. For electrical case, we had a formula for energy because voltage was energy per charge. So all we need to do is to multiply the charge times the voltage to get the energy. So there isn't an equivalent starting point for the magnetic energy. And we did it kind of by looking at this circuit. So for this circuit, first of all, kind of understanding how it works, remember that coils are conservative things. They don't like the current to change. So when the switch closes, the coil says, current isn't going to change. It's going to fight it all the way until the current finally builds up to some final value. And of course, once di dt is zero, then there's no term like this. And so the voltage is, V is just going to equal IR. All of the voltage will just be across the resistor. Okay, so independent of solving the required differential equation and getting this formula for the magnetic time constant, which basically shows how long it takes for the current to build up to its final value, for us the real important point was just taking V equals IR and multiplying it by the current. And then we had a formula for the power in. The power that the battery was supplying is just the voltage times the current. And we got a formula that we recognized, I hope, as joule heating. The resistor is going to get hot according to I squared R. And we had another term. So we know that the energy has to be conserved. If some of it is going into heating, some of it has to go someplace else. And I declared that it was going into magnetic energy, certainly going into the magnetic field. And we can then see that the magnetic energy is just going to be the time derivative of the magnetic power is going to be the time derivative of 1/2 Li squared, just what we got up there. So that was kind of the starting point for all of this stuff. I don't know, we might as well think about the equivalent things for the related circuit, namely where we have a capacitor as opposed to a inductor. And same sort of formula, the sum of the voltages have to equal the voltage supplied by the battery. We've got IR for the resistive voltage drop, and we've got Q over C for the voltage drop across the capacitor. And we can get that charge by integrating the current. So integral differential equations are a whole other topic that you haven't taken a course in. Differential equations you took a course in. So we can convert this integral equation into a differential equation by taking the time derivative of it. So
wait, what does that say? I d t?
Yeah, so this is the integral of I dt, right? That's going to give us the charge. So if I take the time derivative of this integral equation, the battery isn't changing, the resistance isn't changing, but the current is changing. The derivative of the integral is just the integrand. So we've got this as our differential equation. And that is a what sort of differential equation? First order linear homogeneous, right? What could be easier than that? So if I kind of rewrite it in a way that I hope looks even more familiar, you could, should be able to write down what the answer is. Pretty much. So this is an exponentially decaying current. What's happening is, of course, there's no voltage drop across this capacitor originally because there's no charge on that capacitor. So all of the voltage drop is going to be across its resistor. So a huge current starts to flow. How much current? Well, if this is zero, that current is going to be V over R. And it starts to charge up this capacitor, which means that there's now less voltage drop across this resistor. So there's less current going to flow. We finally reach equilibrium when the voltage drop across this capacitor equals the voltage drop being supplied by this battery, and then there's no voltage drop across the resistor, so there's no further current that's going to flow. So we have this exponentially decaying current, which has a time constant that is the product of the resistance times the capacitance. Okay, so if we do exactly what we did with the inductor case, we take the normal sort of Ohm's law equation and we multiply it by the current. Here we see the power going in, here we see the joule heating, and here we see another term. And we can recognize that term as just the time derivative of Q squared over C, right? Because the time derivative of Q is I. And of course, 1/2 Q squared over C is the one of the many formulas we have for the energy that's stored in the capacitor. So we could have started this way if we'd wanted to for the energy that's stored in electric fields, but we had a better starting point than that. Questions? So on to, in fact, some of this is chapter 13. On to chapter 13, and we have, you know, kind of a gear switching going on. So a good part of this course is mathematics, and I don't know, 10% of this course is maybe more practical, where we're designing things like magnet systems. And in chapter 13, we're basically back to practical stuff, where we're dealing with circuits. And we've delayed dealing with circuits so far so that we could have real circuits that have inductors, capacitors, and all of that stuff. And so instead of dealing with them as phasors like we did in 200, we can deal with what's really going on in terms of complex numbers. So I'm hoping you all know lots about complex numbers, but you've got a handout there that should refresh your memory if you don't. And you have a simple circuit. Piece of a cartoon. No one in their right mind would solve this if it wasn't a joke, but I'm obviously not in my right mind. So the plan is to solve, your homework is to solve this circuit. And what I mean by solve it is figure out what the equivalent resistance is. And I figure if you do this circuit, you're never going to be afraid of any other circuit. This circuit is obviously crazy and demented and insane, but so any other circuit is going to be less than this one. So, but for sure, you don't want to try and handle this circuit with the methods we taught you in 200. We need a little bit. It'll work, but there's nothing wrong with doing it with 200 methods. But I mean, the starting point would, of course, be to talk about the current in each one of these resistors. I don't know how many resistors there are there, but boy, that's going to give you a lot of unknowns to solve for. So I hope we're going to get to a simpler approach for solving these sort of ugly circuits. But before we go there, we might as well, you know, we've done inductors, we've done capacitors. We might as well, just for the sake of argument, go through and do kind of the next order case, which would be if we have same sort of circuit. So here's our battery, here's our switch. But now I'm going to have a resistor and an inductor and a capacitor all together. And my bet is, I hope that in mechanics, oddly, you basically work this same problem. Namely, this is your damped harmonic oscillator all over again. But never hurts to do damped harmonic oscillator one more time. You're never done with damped harmonic oscillators. Okay, so let's go to it. So the voltage that's being supplied by this battery has to be the sum of the voltages across all of these guys. So we know then that voltage has to be the voltage drop across the resistor plus the voltage drop across the inductor plus the charge on that capacitor, which is the integral of IdT divided by C. Okay, so nothing new there. I remind you that we tell you that E is minus LDT, but then we always write it as plus LDT, and that's because it's really an EMF. It really goes on this side of the equation. But once you've been told that, from now on, think about it as being like a resistor, so it's on this side of the equation with a plus sign. It's way easier to think about it. At least that's my impression. Okay, so this is an integral differential equation, which we don't like, unless we've taken our course in integral differential equations. So the plan is to take the derivative of this and make it into a differential equation. So the battery has a constant voltage. The resistor isn't changing, but the current is going to be changing. And I take it you know the dot notation from mechanics. So we've got the second derivative of the current. And the derivative of the integral is just the corresponding product. So this is a second order constant coefficient homogeneous differential equation, which I'm sure you solved in differential equations, then you solved it again in mechanics. You're going to solve it again today. Okay, so first thing to do is to kind of reorder things so that the differentials are going from second on down, and to divide everything through by L. So I've got I double dot, and then I've got R over L I dot, and I've got 1 over LC times I. And the next thing to do is to get lazy. 1, 2, 3 symbols. Too many symbols. Let's just call this omega naught squared. Well, we didn't solve so many symbols. We just got rid of one. And actually, here we got 3 symbols, and I'm going to replace it by just 2 beta. But this turns out to be a rational choice, no pun intended. So we've got I double dot plus 2 beta I dot plus omega naught squared I. And I'm not sure how they told you to solve these sorts of equations, but the usual approach is, you know, kind of guess. I can justify why this is a reasonable guess to take, but let me take an exponential function like that. And what's nice about this exponential function is if I take the derivative of this, all that comes down is a r. And if I take the second derivative of this, that just happens again. And so derivatives can be replaced by this unknown r being just multiplied through. So this differential equation now is just reduced to the quadratic equation. like that, right? So I divide, once I've done all of this, I divide everything through by I, we've got a quadratic equation, and we all learned how to solve the quadratic equation in high school. It's the opposite of b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac all over 2. And you can kind of see why I put that 2 in there. So now this is minus beta plus or minus. Well, I'm thinking that this term is bigger than this term. It doesn't have to be. We can have underdamping and overdamping and all that sort of stuff that you talked about. But let me assume that this is actually a negative number under the radical, so I'm going to pull out the I, and then I'm going to have omega naught squared minus beta squared. And this quantity here, I'm going to call omega prime. Okay, so our general solution then is a linear combination of these two solutions. So we would have the current being some unknown constant, e to the minus beta t, e to the plus I omega prime t, and an unknown constant, e to the minus beta t, e to the minus I omega prime t. And I can rewrite that if I want as being some new unknown constant, exponential decay, and then I can put together these two pieces to give me a cosine with some sort of phase factor. Okay, so we did that fast because you've done it many times in your life, I think. So here we have an amplitude, a damped oscillator that's oscillating not at the natural frequency, but typically at a frequency that's very close to it because beta is small, at least in the underdamping case. And you all know, I hope remember about overdamping and critical damping and all that sort of stuff could be repeated. Okay? So now we've done all of the good stuff. Because it's a different A from this one. Say again? I didn't want to. I used an A so that it's an amplitude. I didn't give it a whole lot of thought. So, what's the upshot of dealing with circuits the way we're going to be dealing with them? And the short story is that we can treat capacitors, resistors, inductors as all the same sort of thing if we just change the definition of resistance to include the possibility that it's complex. Okay, so the resistance of an inductor, I'm going to say, is I omega L. Yeah, so it's in quotes. The thing that acts exactly like a resistance for an inductor is I omega L, and the thing that acts exactly like a resistance for a capacitor is 1 over I omega C. And if I just crank away exactly like I would for resistors, using these things for the resistances of inductors, and apply Kirchhoff's laws, it works. In the end, everything's going to turn out to be happy and carefree. So, I mean, that's the very bottom line. All you need to know is that, and the R for resistor is, of course, R. All we need to know is what we knew from 200 and a little bit about complex numbers, and we can solve any old circuit. So, I don't know, what's kind of the why about why this all works? So the first thing maybe to think about is, what is this omega? So I am thinking about a circuit where I have not a DC source, but I've got a Wavetech that is tuned to a particular frequency. Well, what if I've got multiple frequencies present? Well, it turns out that there is superposition that goes for circuits too. So I could solve the circuit for the one source, I could solve the circuit for the other source, and I could just add them up to get the result for two different circuits. what if this wave tech is set to produce a square wave as opposed to a sinusoidal wave? Well, Fourier promised us that any wave shape could be written as a sum of harmonics. So I could just solve it for the general frequency omega and then put in all of the harmonics and then add up the results, and I could see what would happen with a square wave or a triangular wave or any imaginable wave. So the upshot of all of this is that sinusoidally varying sources are the main game. So even if you don't literally have a wave tech tuned to a particular frequency, you still want to go through assuming your circuits have that, because you can then solve any old circuit. Well, okay, the wave tech doesn't produce voltages that are like e to the I omega t, right? It produces voltages that are real numbers with some presumable phase shift. So why do I get to say that my voltages, currents, etc., all of them are proportional to e to the I omega t? Well, the main point in all of this is that the differential equations that we have for these circuits only involve real constant coefficients. And that means that the real and imaginary parts of any solution to this will separately solve this equation. So I don't hurt myself by tacking on the I sine omega t that's implicit in writing it, because as long as I at the end realize I only want the real part. And it's a whole lot easier to take derivatives of things that are e to the I omega t than it is to take derivatives of sine or cosine. Well, you say it isn't that much harder to take derivatives of sine or cosine. Is it really worth what's going on? Well, the real reason to be using this e to the I omega t is in a circuit like this, if the current was a cosine, then the voltage drop across this thing would be a derivative of a cosine. It would be a sine. And this would also be a sine, so we would have to be adding up sines and cosines in order to figure out what the net voltage is across here. And adding up sines and cosines, well, it's not super hard, but it's not a lot of fun. Whereas it's real easy to add up exponentials. Okay, so I don't know, for all of those reasons, we're now going to say all the time that voltage is V naught, say e to the I omega t. And I don't know, there's some differences which are not particular differences. Sometimes people will write e to the minus I omega t. Okay, I can live with that. This voltage here is the voltage amplitude, the peak that you're going to have, because of course this e to the I omega t is a sine and a cosine, so it has a maximum value of 1. You know that, in fact, all of your instruments are going to read the RMS voltage. And you all know from 370 last semester, if nothing else, that the RMS voltage is just the voltage divided by the square root of 2. So even though your meters are going to read in RMS values, it's more convenient to write your equations in terms of the peak values. And whatever is true of the peak values is also true of the RMS value. So we're home free. Okay, so we're always going to be writing this sort of stuff. How do we get these phase shifts, which may or may not be present? Well, that's pretty easy, because this V naught, it doesn't have to be a real number. It could be some positive number with some phase shift. And then when I put it together with this, I'm going to get exactly that. So I can deal with phase shifts in an easy way just by thinking about these amplitudes as being complex numbers. And I can deal with sine and cosine collectively just by having oscillating exponentials. Okay, so where do these formulas that we have for the resistance come about? Well, the formula we just had for our damped harmonic oscillator was that the voltage was equal to the voltage drop across the resistor plus the voltage drop across the inductor. That's a di dt. plus the voltage drop across the capacitor. And if the current is equal to one of these amplitudes times e to the I omega t, then when I take the derivative of this, I'm just going to get I omega L times I. And when I take the integral, I'm going to get 1 over I omega times I. And of course, it's all over C. So you can see that what I'm getting here in the end is R plus I omega L plus 1 over I omega C all times I. So it's exactly as if this were the equivalent resistance of the inductor and this were the equivalent resistance of the capacitor. And we can immediately see, I hope, that this voltage is going to be some V naught e to the I omega t, and this I was some I naught e to the I omega t. So we immediately have that this amplitude is equal to the series combination of those resistances times I naught. So this thing here, this is some sort of total impedance, which we have a tendency to use Z for. And I can write that as a magnitude and an angle. And so what I see then is that the magnitude of V naught is just the magnitude of the impedance times the magnitude of the current. And if I want the phase shift, the voltage is going to be the magnitude of Z I naught e to the I omega t plus phi. So the phase shift between the current and the voltage is just the phase shift that we have for the impedance Z. Okay, and you did all this before in 200 with phasors, right? So we're not going to go through all of the phasor stuff because it's obsolete at this point, but let me at least make the connection. You might remember that what we said is that we had this rotating vector, and boy, rotating vector that's going at omega, e to the I omega t. And what we said is that the voltage across an inductor was leading by 90 degrees. Well, here we have the voltage across the inductor, and it's got an I in it. I is e to the I 90 degrees. So the voltage across the inductor is going to be ahead by 90 degrees. We said that the voltage drop across the capacitor was trailing by 90 degrees. Well, we've got 1 over I. 1 over I is e to the minus I times 90 degrees. And then we just vector added these up. Well, that's what adding complex numbers is. It's vector addition in 2 dimensions. So we said that the net voltage was, you know, something like that with some phase angle that we could then go and calculate. Okay, so 200 was just complex numbers without complex numbers. And you know, maybe we could continue in that game, but it turns out that this phasor game really only works for the case that we worked it in 200. If we try and do parallel circuits as opposed to series circuits, you kind of have to throw your hands up. It's becomes way easier to think about it in terms of the complex impedances. Okay, so I repeat, with inductors, capacitors, and resistors, everything is exactly like it is with resistors, except now we have funny formulas, funny complex formulas for what the resistance is of an inductor. So if you want to know what the series combination is of capacitors, inductors, and resistors, you just add them up. If you want to know what a parallel combination of these things are, you just use the usual formula for parallel combination of resistors, right, where they add in inverses. So I don't know, it might be worth reminding you that with capacitors, it was backwards, right? So with resistors, which I consider the normal case, I'm not sure. Usually we talk about capacitors first, but Right, so here's the formula for the parallel combination of resistors, and here's the formula for the parallel combination of capacitors. Is it going to work out that way? Well, so my claim is that we can just treat capacitors like resistors, except where the resistance, we're supposed to use 1 over omega C. So if I plug that in, I have 1 over omega C total is equal to 1 over I omega C1 plus 1 over I omega C2. And you can see it's going to work, right? We're going to have that the capacitances in parallel add the way resistors do in series. Okay, so everything's a resistor. The only thing that's new is that we have some pretty funny resistances to deal with. And you are required to figure out how to add, subtract, multiply, divide, take the sign of complex numbers now using your calculator. It can do all of those things. I'm not sure my homework, I guess the starting homework problems do force you to do that. But you know, since this is a junior level course, pretty quickly we end up doing algebra as opposed to using our calculators. But do know that if you actually had numerical values for your capacitor, inductor, you could crank them out on your calculator just fine. Okay? So, let's go in the Wayback Machine and go back to 200 and remember, I think we talked briefly about this, but basically my plan had been to hold off talking about Kirchhoff's laws until we got to things that were more interesting. But let's talk about it. So the way we taught you how to do this in 200 was for every wire, you put an arrow on it that indicated your guess as to how the current was going to go in that wire. And it didn't matter which way you put the arrow. In the end, everyone's going to get the same answer. These currents are the unknowns. Those currents are the unknowns in the equations we're going to write down using Kirchhoff's laws. And what we're going to have is various loops. So one rule is Kirchhoff's current rule, and it says that the current flowing into a junction has to be equal to the current that's flowing out of the junction. So for that particular junction, what I could say, for example, is that the current flowing in is I2 plus I3, and the current flowing out is equal to I4. So for every one of these junctions, I could write down a similar sort of equation. So here it's going to be I1 is equal to I3 plus I5. And in the end, we've got lots of unknowns, so we're going to need lots of equations. So the other rule we had, which is probably the trickier rule to apply, is the loop rule. And we can choose any loop we want. Let's choose a crazy one to start with. So let's choose this as our loop. Any loop that you want. And as you go around this loop, think about how the voltages are changing. So, I don't know, for me, I think about the boundary waters, right? So if you put it in a particular spot, there used to be those trucks that would take your canoe up some big hill. And then you could paddle around, sometimes going with the rapids, sometimes fighting the rapids. But if you put in where you came out, that means that the net altitude change was going to be zero. So I think about this as kind of altitude changes. And if I'm fighting the rapids, if I'm going like this, then I have to be going uphill. So I'm going to have a plus IR. If I'm going with the flow, then I must be going downhill, so I'm going to have a minus IR. Things like this are where we're being hauled uphill. We're going to higher voltages, and if we go through a battery like this, then we're going downhill. Right? Never do that in your canoe. And with that, we just write down what's going on. So if I start here, I'm going uphill, so it's going to be a plus V. Here I'm going with the flow, so it's going to be minus I2R2. Here I'm fighting the current, so I'm going to be going uphill with I3 times R3. And here I'm going with the flow again, so it's going to be minus I5 R5. I did this with erasable ones, so I could do it again. Okay, and some of those altitude changes have to be zero. Okay, so what I've got is five unknowns, and now I've got three equations, so I need more loops in order to have as many equations as I've got loops. Well, you can choose any old loop you want. So let's choose this loop, where I'm going around this way. So if I start here, I'm going with the flow, so I'm going downhill with a minus I2 R2. Here I'm fighting the current, so it's going to be plus I3 R3. And here I'm fighting the current, so it's going to be plus I1 R1. Okay, so now I got four equations and four unknowns. Here's another loop down here I could, for example, use. So the only mistake you can make in all of this is if you choose loops that are already chosen in a subtle way. Okay, so for example, I might think that I have three different loops if I used the loop that I used the first time, the one that went like that, and then I chose for my second loop that loop, and then I chose for my third loop this loop. But this loop is obviously just the sum of those two loops, so it's not new information. And there's no harm in that. If you again use row reduced echelon form on your calculators with numerical problems, it'll give you the strong hint that you don't have enough equations, because you won't have zeros and ones down the main diagonal. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you can play with your row reduced echelon form. It's good way to solve linear equations. Unfortunately, most of the problems I have for you are algebra as opposed to numerical problems like back in 200. But I do want to advertise for you to figure out how to solve normal 200 level linear equations with your calculators. Okay, so here are kind of some potentially more complicated sort of situations. One thing to kind of recognize is this separation between B and D is totally fake, right? This is one big junction. There are no resistors here. There's no reason to actually treat B and D as being discretely different points. But otherwise, this thing is going to, and therefore, there's no reason to have an I3, right? I can reduce my number of unknowns by one. Where's the other one? So here's another circuit, and if you think about it for a second, I naught is not an unknown. You can figure out what I naught is pretty quickly. If we call the voltage here at B0, then I can figure out what the voltage is here at A, it's going to be E1, and I can figure out what the voltage is here at C, it's going to be E2, because we're going up in both senses from zero, and therefore I know the voltage drop across this resistor, so I can calculate the current going through it. Okay, so there are all sorts of kind of special situations that allow you to reduce the number of unknowns in your equations and make the solving of them potentially easier. Okay, so that's 200 level. Supposedly, there are easier ways of solving these equations. What are those easier ways? I'm looking for an eraser. Nah, I'm gonna go get some toilet paper. So what's the probability that the toilet is in use?
There's only one.
In this upstairs one, you know. Okay. So this was the hard way. So much for easy erasing. Yeah, you don't see anything. I can see lots of ugly stuff. It's perfect. So the idea to make this easier is to have fewer unknowns. And that's going to mean to kind of automatically satisfy one of Kirchhoff's laws without making those separate equations. And the best way to do that, and I think the best way overall, is what's called the node method. And it's best for a couple of reasons, but maybe I'll hold off talking about all of its nice advantages. If we think about the canoe problem, there really isn't, if we know what the altitude is of each spot, then we don't have to worry about the continuity of the altitudes, right? So I can just call as my one unknown the voltage here, let me call it VA, and call the voltage there VB. And whatever those things are, you know, if I say that this is 5 and this is 2, automatically it's going to satisfy the voltage summation rule. So the only thing I have left to do then is to satisfy the current conservation rule. And we can do that in a really standardized fashion that's very mechanical, so we don't even have to give it a lot of thought. So if I think about what current conservation is going to look like for this particular node, I'm going to consistently calculate the current that's going into this node, and the sum of those things better be zero. So how much current is going to be coming through this resistor? Well, I can easily calculate it. It's going to be V minus VA divided by R2. How much current is going to be coming in through this resistor? Well, it's going to be VB minus VA divided by R3. How much current is going to be coming in through this node here? Well, it's going to be 0 minus VA divided by R4. So the sum of those things have to be 0. Do people believe all of that? So what I'm consistently doing is I'm taking the far voltage and subtracting the home voltage and dividing it by the resistance, because that gives me the voltage drop across that resistor. And if the one is higher, then current is flowing in, and if this one's lower, the current is flowing out, which is exactly what these signs give me. So here, the voltage here is 0, right? So it's 0 minus VA. So one equation, one unknown, all I need to do is to do the same sort of thing for this guy here. So what I'm going to have here is the current that's flowing through R1 is V minus VB divided by R1. And here I have VA minus VB divided by R3, and here I have 0 minus VB divided by R5. All has to add up to 0. And pretty soon you don't have to think about this at all, right? Take the far voltage, subtract the home voltage, divide by the resistance, do that for everything that comes into that junction, and set it equal to 0. So instead of having 5 unknowns, I've got 2 unknowns. Now these equations kind of look a little bit uglier than the typical ones because they have denominators as opposed to numerators. But for a real problem, I mean, that resistance is, you know, 2.36 mega ohms or something like that. You don't actually want to, you can't actually, the only cases where you would actually solve these sorts of problems by hand are the fake problems that we have in 200, right? Where we have 2 ohm resistors and 5 ohm resistors and we multiply the 2 times 5 and the 5 times 2 and subtract, right? You're never going to do that with real valued resistors. You're going to solve these things on a computer or your calculator. So it doesn't matter that these equations look a little bit nastier because you can't actually solve them the way you wouldn't want to solve real valued resistors, inductors, capacitor problems with the usual sort of mechanisms from 200. Okay, so advantages. So one advantage is this is real mechanical. You don't have to think. I'm always just taking far minus home, dividing it by a resistor. So don't even think about which way the current is flowing. Just do that. Way fewer unknowns to solve for in the end. And even more importantly, the unknowns that you care about. That is to say, if you are going to do something with this circuit, you want to know the voltages because that's what you can easily measure. If you wanted to measure what the current is through this resistor, you would have to break that wire, which is complicated, and then put in your ammeter to measure that current. So voltages are what's easily measured with an oscilloscope or a voltmeter. Currents are hard to measure, and this method gives us the voltages directly, whereas the kind of old-fashioned 200 method gives us the currents, and if we wanted the voltages, we'd have to go through the process of calculating them.
Do we need to know the arrows, do we?
No, there are no arrows. I never talked about the arrows.
I know. But I'm saying you could have done it the opposite way and said it was. How do you know that only one of them is going to be 0? How did you know that the last one right there was going to be 0?
Well, really, it's a declaration. So whatever the voltage is on this wire, I could declare it to be anything. And I could choose another spot to be 0.
Yeah.
But typically, people write this circuit, and this is the negative supply. People are thinking about this as being ground. But there's no reason I couldn't have declared this to be 0 and gotten some other values. But so a starting point is to declare a point to be 0.
What's the best method for choosing the number of points?
So typically you have to use every node. So there isn't a choice involved.
Every junction.
But in this one,
you want to do the top.
Yeah, so I guess I wouldn't call this a junction, but I guess it is in some sense.
But going back to the not using the arrows, how'd you know to do VB minus VA and not have it going the other way in VA minus VB?
So first of all, it doesn't matter. You can choose as long as you are consistent to either use far minus home or home minus far.
Right, but in that case, how are you defining what's home and what's far?
So home is the one that I'm trying to figure out for this junction.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I see it. Okay.
We're good?
Yeah.
And I at least like to go far minus home. Actually, pretty commonly in electrical engineering books, they do the reverse. But it obviously it doesn't make any difference. okay, so how are we going to solve this problem? Right? So, first of all, there are 13 nodes, if I recall correctly. So in the end, we're going to have to solve 13 equations and 13 unknowns. And if you do it by hand, we'll call the funny farm and have you taken away. Right? You're going to solve this with Mathematica. At least I would solve it with Mathematica. And if we have time, I'll show you exactly how to do that. Okay, so we need to declare some place to be 0 volts, and that's the dead obvious place to consider 0 volts. So I think this one's going to be 0, and then I just need to label all of these other spots. So and this labeling is going to be pretty much arbitrary, but I do have to hit every one. I can see it perfectly well. Complaints. All I get is complaints. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So here's it. So these little arrows, those are not junctions. So there's 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Technically
9
and 5 are the same.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 5 and 9 are the same.
And then right above 4.
Yeah.
Oh. And right above 4. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that one wants to be 9, I guess, huh? And so what we need, and what I'm thinking about is that this V13 is some fixed voltage. So that's not a variable that's being supplied by some outside source. And what I need to do then is to just write down all of the equations. So if we pick 9, for example, what I'm going to have then is V3 minus V9 divided by 1 plus V8 minus V9 plus V10 minus V9 has to add up to 0.
And there's always
going to
be
3. No, Like here for 5, there are a huge number of things that are coming together. So let's do 5. We're probably going to make a mistake. So what we have is 0 minus V5 for that one. And here we have V1 minus V5 for that one. And here we have V4 minus V5, and here we have V11 minus V5, and here we have V13 minus V5, and here we have V10 minus V5, and here we have V6 minus V5. Nope, not done yet. So, and then finally we have V2 minus V5. And I hope you see, I'm not doing a lot of thinking, right? I'm always just looking at farm minus home and adding them all up.
How many things did you get?
Now one, there is one thing that's a little bit tricky that maybe I should mention now as opposed to when you ask me about it. What do we do with this one here at 0? What's the total current for it? Well, 0 is connected to 13, right? Whatever current is flowing down this path, that same current is going into 13. I probably can't fit them both on at the same time. So remember that when you're dealing with this particular guy. Okay? So in the end, when you plug this all into your calculator, what you're going to get out is lots of these voltages in terms of V13. right? Because V13 is the set voltages. So you'll learn that V5 is a 20th of V13 or something like that, some small fraction of it. How do we actually get the equivalent resistance? Well, the resistance is the voltage, V13, divided by the current. And what is the current? Well, you could calculate it any number of ways, but it's pretty convenient to calculate here at zero. The total current is going to be V1 minus zero, that's the current that's going in here, plus V5 minus zero, that's the current that's flowing in there, plus V2 minus V0, that's the current that's flowing in there, right? And all that current is going down the drain. Oh, I think I made a mistake. So this, what is this term here? I don't know why that's V5. That's because that's from the other.
Okay, but even for the V5 one, isn't it supposed to be 0 minus V5? It's on the second line, the first.
Should be V5 minus 0, but this thing here, I'm not even. Oh, I guess that was.
No, she's talking about.
When you were trying to make an equation for V5.
Oh, this one up here? Yeah, there are unfortunately two equations that are now irreducibly smashed together and are all in red.
The first line is one, and then the next three are.
No, okay, let me.
Oh, so this was a zero here, huh?
What's this in that?
Oh, did I write that term twice?
No, that's V6. Oh, I thought that.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Okay, so.
It's already done.
Say again?
She's complaining.
Well, it's.
Shut up.
I didn't say anything. Just almost said something. It's coming up slowly. So here is kind of the setup. Right? So lots of these sorts of equations in Mathematica. Mathematica wants the double equal sign in order to do it. Separate all those equations by commas. Put all of the equations between curly brackets. And then give the list of things that Mathematica wants to solve. And then this was the current. And this thing is going to give you an answer, so the first answer is the only answer, so I take the first answer, and then the ohms are going to be the voltage divided by the current. I don't know, so if you write fast, you can write down that answer, and at least confirm or deny that we did it the same way, whether it's the same right way or not, I don't know. Believe it or not, I'm not the first crazy person to assign this. So if you actually look online, you can find other people's answers to it.
Can you go back up so I can see that? You don't have to show me answers.
I'm happy to show you the answer, because you're going to turn in this code. You're going to print out this thing and do that until you get that answer. That would be fine with me. I don't know. I forget what this is. I think it's some online discussion about about all of the little bits that are in that. Not found. Okay, so it's some sort of dead link. Oh, okay. So it is all here. Oh, let's see. So it's almost time to be doing this one. Well, okay. I'm done, I guess.
What does the divide dot mean again?
So that's use that equation. So
you had like I equals, and then you had three things, and then
yep. So the output, well, okay, let's.
Sorry.
That's okay. Don't tell me it won't go on after it, after you turn it off.
Listen, it's so mad.
Yeah. Oh well. Oh, okay. Is anything good happening?
It is green, and now it's flashing green.
You could just see it on the screen there. Oh well. If that comes on, we'll come back to it. So what's the second method? Right. This is the very much advertised method as being the way you want to do it. But there is another method that is good for... This thing probably doesn't like to be turned on and off a lot either. So this is the output of that solve equation. And it's got a lot of... So it is a set of sets. So the first thing in this set is this set. And it has lots of V1 goes to something, V2 goes to something. And what that slash dot says is to apply all of these rules.
Okay.
So when I do this, it's...
And why did you just do V1, V9, and V2?
Because that's what the current is, right? If you remember the setup, there are only those three wires that come into the bottom part.
Oh, okay.
I probably chose different numbers, but...
Okay. So it'd be like
1, 5, 2,
okay?
Yeah, so... I'm going to apply that. Oh, this thing isn't set up the way I like it. There it is. And of course, if I take the result of that, take I and now divide it by V13, I get the final current. Okay? Last chance for questions. Okay, so what's the other method? So the other method is called the mesh method, and it would not be a good one to apply in this particular case, as you will see. So with the mesh method, so remember the idea that the node method was that we automatically, you would think that things would remain damp for longer than that. Perfectly clean. Perfect. Perfect.
Good.
Oh, great. Throw it. But I think I'll be able to dry it off. Shall I throw it back? I'm going to close it, though. Okay. So the plan with the node method was to automatically satisfy the voltage summation rules with a mesh method that... with the mesh... M-E-S-H method. The idea is to automatically solve the current conservation rules. And what we're going to do is to kind of arbitrarily imagine some so-called mesh currents. So here's going to be a mesh current. Here's going to be a mesh current. So these are not currents through resistors. These are currents that are going around in circles. And since they're going around in circles, the current is going to be automatically satisfied. But now, if I ask, what is the current through this resistor?
Well,
I think I went around that way and I went around this way. So the current through this resistor is fighting the current, and it's I1 plus I2. So I would have a term that is R2 was plus R2 times I2 plus I1. Where are they clashing? So for this resistor here, they're clashing. So if I was going through this thing in this direction, what I would write would be, it's downhill in terms of I2, but it's up. I can't read which way that arrow is going. I'm going to pretend it's going that way. But it's uphill in terms of I3. So the mesh currents are continuous currents that are going around in the smallest available window in the circuit. And then they are automatically conserved. And then the current through any particular resistor is just the sum of those currents. OK, so mesh method, node method, almost all. So if you want names, Dean likes the mesh method. That's Langley's approach. I like the node method.
We
spend a lot of time worrying about it. So the mesh method is kind of, I have to agree that it's cute. The node method isn't so cute, but it, generally speaking, works better. So I can argue, obviously, with Dean. One of the things that's bad about this is that, again, if after we solve this equation, what do we got? We got currents. Who cares about the currents? We want the voltages, right? That's what you can actually measure with a meter easily. So obviously, Dean is wrong, and I'm right. So you would just add them up. So we automatically satisfied current conservation. So now we have to, by hand, satisfy the voltage rules. So we have to add up all of these voltages and set them equal to zero. Okay, and we also have more unknowns in this equation than we had with the nodes rule, although that is a switch off. Some circuits have more meshes than nodes, and other circuits have more nodes than meshes. So for example, this circuit here, no, it's worse, right? So first of all, it's actually impossible, but I won't talk about that. I mean, for every one of these little things, you'd want to have a little mesh current. And then you'd want to write all of those Kirchhoff's loops, right? Unimaginable. But if you have both of these arrows in your quiver, you can solve lots of problems. So both Dean can be happy, and I can be happy. And you can be happy. I'm always happy, except at exam time, when people are going to the dentist.
Yeah, just throw that in there. Wait, when's our next test again?
2 weeks.
Both came on
up. What's kind of in the future? So we're going to we've really covered all of chapter 13 already, but we're going to spend another time on it so we can have two homeworks on it.
It's on Thursday, right?
And then we'll go on to, we're going to then skip the next two chapters, which deal with particular areas of physics, plasma physics and superconductors. So we're going to jump after chapter 13 to chapter 16, and chapter 16 will be the final entry point for the exam.
Thursday the 18th.
It's Thursday, 2 weeks. If that's the 18th, then yes.
Is it 2 weeks from today?
2 weeks from today.
Okay.
And it's in all of this stuff is